The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We call our third case for today, 01-3198, John C. Hagan versus the City of Milwaukee Employees Retirement System Annuity and Pension Board. What's the initials that we say? Work?
MERS.
Okay. Arguing for Mr. Hagan is Michael T. Sheedy, who has 25 minutes and then 5 in rebuttal, and Morita F. Horan. That pronounced properly. Arguing for the City of Milwaukee Employees Retirement System Annuity and Pension Board. Counsel, you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I was telling Marita here, my name is Mike Sheedy. I represent Mr. Hagan. I've never been here since the day I was sworn into this court, so I think I'm as nervous as her. She's as nervous as me.
Well, as I explained to someone this morning, we're especially hard on first-timers. So that ought to reassure you and comfort you.
Okay.
And, counsel, we're going to have trouble hearing you.
I have a cold, and so does she. She gave me a lifesaver before we started, so I'll try to speak up.
So speak slow as you can and as close to the microphone,
okay.
And that would be very helpful.
I learned a bad habit from my father, talking very fast, and so I will try to slow down. Basically, we're here on a case that kind of reminds me of a civil procedure test. Marina and I don't truly disagree on most of the things that occurred here, other than the fact that I believe Mr. Hagan's still disabled and they don't.
Okay, let's speak up. Sorry.
Mr. Hagan's disabled and they don't believe he was. In any of that.
Now we can hear you when you're a little closer to the mic.
Okay. I was reading this thing earlier and said I shouldn't talk into the mic, but I'll talk into it.
Well, okay.
Lies.
Okay. In any event, after Mr. Hagan failed to prevail at the administrative level, I brought an action for review, which we filed in the court. I employed a private process server by the name of Badger Service. Badger Service has been around for years, and the gentleman that serves these processes has been around for years. On the summons and complaint, it directed that the service be sent to the MERS office in room 603. I mean, it couldn't be any clearer to a four-year-old as to where you're supposed to go. Apparently, Mr. Byers went into this office, and an individual who's at the desk, he showed them the process, and that individual directed him to the clerk's office. Well, we don't know who that individual is. Although Ann Barr had a paralegal investigate to see who it was, I don't know if anybody's been in this office, but it's a reception area that's separate from the regular offices. Mr. Myers then went down to the office where he was directed to go, which was the city clerk, where he gave the process to the city clerk, who raised no objections whatsoever. Marita raised an affirmative defense that there wasn't proper service. We sent her over the affidavit, and at a later point in time, she brought a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. Now, in going through the cases here, there seems like there's four cases that we all focus on. The Kesky case, the Horrigan case, the Gomez case, and the Barcode case. I'll try to distinguish these cases. And the best I could is that in Kesky, the gentleman went, took the right office, and apparently got the wrong guy. In Horrigan.
Okay, I'm still having difficulty.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Right office, wrong guy.
Wrong guy.
Okay.
In Horrigan, it's the right office and the wrong guy. Okay? In Gomez,
both of them are wrong guys.
Wrong guys. Well, they said that they're not the person not apparently in charge. In Gomez, you go to the wrong office and serve the wrong person. Instead of going to the workers' comp, they go to the LIRC.
and give it to a receptionist, and apparently that receptionist then gives it to workers' comp. In barcode, the guy goes into the Ameritech office, which is the right building but the wrong office, and gives it to the security guard at the front desk who accepts service. So there's like two cases that are on my side and two cases that are on Marita's side, but they're not, this particular case doesn't fit any of those particular holes or boxes. Because in this case, Mr. Meyer went to the right office in the right building, apparently talked to the person in charge, who then sent him to the wrong office where somebody accepted service. Now, the Kesky case.
So we got right office, right building, right guy, wrong office, wrong guy.
Right.
Yeah. So we have a situation that's really a little bit different than any of the four cases here. When you show somebody the process in the right office, and they're apparently...
Stay in front of the microphone.
Oh, you show them the process, theoretically, that service. I mean, some people won't accept process. You got to throw it at them. My father tells a story, and I don't know if this is true or not, but this old process server was trying to get this doctor, who was quite wily, and he couldn't get the doctor. So what the guy did was he went outside the guy's house and called him up at 2 o'clock in the morning and told him his garage is on fire. So the guy came running up. He served him with the process. Now, some people will evade process. I don't think that's what happened here. And I don't think that the process server was intentionally misled here. I think what happened here was the individual, the receptionist, sent him to the wrong place.
Served the receptionist?
He showed it to her. His affidavit says he showed it to her, and then she said go somewhere else. So I guess the one thing that wasn't effectuated is that she didn't actually get an authenticated copy. The authenticated copy went down to the clerk's office, and the clerk stamps it and gives a receipt for it and doesn't raise any objection.
Now, counsel, I just want to ask, in the testimony or the brief summary I have, the secretary or the person in the right office where your process server first went, she denied that she ever had this conversation. So that was a question of fact for the judge to decide whether your process server was ever in 603.
That, theoretically, that's true. Ann Barr, who is the executive director of MERS, in her affidavit said that she had a paralegal ask around as to who did this, and they couldn't find out who did it. It seems to me someone should know who is at the front desk in your office. I mean, I would know at my office who was at the front desk at a certain point in time, but theoretically it could be anybody else.
Well, is it undisputed fact in this case that your process server actually went into the right office?
Yes.
Initially?
Yes. That's what his affidavit says. I wasn't there. But,
okay, but does MERS dispute that?
I don't believe they do.
Follow up Justice Wilcox's question. My understanding of the affidavit, or supplemental affidavit, if I have the right case, is that the city of Milwaukee doesn't deny it, but rather takes the position, essentially, of they are unable to verify. No, well,
I believe it's in the back of Marita's brief at page 146, Your Honor, where Kathleen Marquardt says that she was a staff assistant in the city clerk's office, and the city clerk's office accepts process only for the city of Milwaukee. And that
what page, counsel? 146?
146, okay, in the back of the red one, Your Honor?
Yes. Thank you.
What I was referring to is page 150, and the number 5, which in essence reads that and this is someone from MERS, this is the executive director of MERS supplemental affidavit, and in number 5, this executive director of MERS.
Right.
indicates that she investigated whether anyone has any knowledge of referring anyone to the city clerk's office for acceptance of service. Our investigation has revealed that the front office personnel has no knowledge of ever referring anyone to city clerk's office for acceptance of service. So I'm going to tell you what my understanding of the facts are based on the affidavit, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong, okay? I understand that your affidavit indicates, as you are stating, that you went to the process server, went to the office, said what was up, and was instructed to go to the city clerk's office. I understand that's what your affidavit of your process server says. I understand that the affidavit and supplemental affidavit of MERS indicates no knowledge of ever referring anyone to the city clerk's office, and then the city clerk's affidavit indicates that they are only authorized to accept service for the city. Now, have I stated it correctly?
You have, Your Honor. Kind of reminds me of when I want to know at my house who drank the last soda. Nobody has any knowledge of what happened to the last soda.
From the office of the city clerk, you have on Appendix 148, I thought what was the verification of the service of the city clerk. Now, I might be wrong. Take a look at that. I mean, isn't that what that's supposed to be? In other words, verification that the summons and complaint were served on the city clerk.
That's true. In fact, on page 148, they gave him a receipt.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to. I guess on this appendix, it's 148.
Well, it's all one building. It's a beautiful old building, and there's various places in there. And to the uninitiated, it would all seem as that it's a city.
Who can serve this summons and complaint?
Any adult, I believe the statutes are anybody that's.
How do you serve it? By just.
Well, there's a right
to the office.
Walk in and say, I got some process for you. Will you take it? And at my office, my secretary will say, I'm not going to accept process. You know,
Why wasn't the city attorney's office forwarding the affidavit of service?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Well, ultimately, MERS got this, right? They got the summons. They got the complaint. I'm sorry.
Well, at least I know that Marita got it somehow. I imagine that Ms. Marquardt took it up to that office.
Why wasn't that service?
I would think that is service. In fact, Judge Sundby, at the end of Gomez, has an interesting comment about a case called, that was not in my brief or Marita's brief, called...
Please stand in front of me.
I'm sorry. It was called Fontaine versus Milwaukee County Expressway Commission, 31 Wisconsin 2nd, 275.
What was that site again, please?
It was 31 Wisconsin 2nd, 275.
What does that say?
Well, Jay Sundby concurring in Gomez, I didn't read it the same way he did because I went and got Fontaine, but essentially what he said was in Gomez, the woman went to the wrong desk. She went to the LRC and served the wrong person. However, that person then took that process and took it up to the LRC. And Judge Sundby said, if this was not an administrative case where you have to serve it exactly the way you do with it, if it was just a regular case like this, he says that he believes under Fontaine that would be service.
Now here, just so I get the fact, here, after MERS, then... they alleged improper service.
That's correct.
And you were aware of that.
That's correct.
And then you faxed them an affidavit of service requesting that they remove the affirmative defense. But then after you knew that they were using that as a defense, you still had 90 days to serve them?
In hindsight, I would have gone and reserved them if I would have known exactly what happened here, but I never got any information back as to why that service was not proper. I mean, typically what happens, I actually have a case where I'm accused of this in the Court of Appeals of kitchen sink pleadings, where people
raise all kinds of affirmative defenses under 80206 because they don't want to waive those affirmative defenses. So you see that all the time when somebody comes and says, on information and belief, I didn't get proper service, and you send it over to the other lawyer.
So what did you do when you received the answer with the affirmative defense?
I called Marita's office. Marita's part-time. We left voicemail asking her if they remove the affirmative defense and faxed over to them the proof of service.
Then what'd she say?
She didn't get back to me.
Pardon me?
She didn't get back to me.
Until after the 90 days expired?
Yes, ma'am.
Let's take a look at the statute. Because I'm kind of, the right guy, the wrong place, and the wrong guy, the right place is, as we say, a Byzantine maze, or at least some people say. So let's take a look at the statute, and that is 801.11.4b. Let me tell you the question I have in this case. First, in looking at that statute.
We're going to find it first.
I believe we've got statute books over there, so if you can't find your copy, right, there you go. That council, that's 801.11.4b.
I believe 5.
801.11.4b.
802, that's right. It's actually 5A, Your Honor.
Stick with me on 801.11.4b, if you would.
Okay.
And then you can explain why it's 5A. Um, 801.11.4b indicates, in lieu of delivering the copy of the summons to the person specified, the copy may be left in the office of such officer, director, or managing agent with the person who is apparently in charge of the office. So you're following me on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the statute, I believe, that the Court of Appeals relied on in analyzing this case. Am I correct?
I'm not positive of that, Your Honor.
Paragraph 17 of the Court of Appeals case is their concluding paragraph, in essence, and it refers to that. So let's say that's what they're relying on. This is my question. I think based on case law, in my mind, it is settled that the phrase, who is apparently in charge of the office, is construed to be viewed from the perspective of a reasonable process server. That is, who would a reasonable process server think is apparently in charge of the office? That's what I think the law is. My question with regard to the other component of that sub B is, and that other component, in the office of such officer, etc., how are we to view this phrase, may be left in the office of? Are we to view that phrase from the perspective of what a reasonable process server would think, or are we to view that phrase absolutely literally?
I think you were right in the first place. It's what a reasonable process server would believe. I think in Kesky they said that it's not a game of hide and seek, and nor is it something that he has to go and inquire of people as to their actual authority to receive this. It's in his mind as to who he believes is apparently in charge.
That's, well,
as I said, I'm looking at two phrases. One is who's apparently in charge, and I know the law, I think I know the law on that, and that is from the perspective of what a reasonable process server would think.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I want to know how we view may be left in the office of. Is that phrase from the perspective of a reasonable process server, or is it literal, or is it something else?
Well, it's kind of vague, Your Honor, in my opinion, because you could read it that somebody could walk in and leave it in the office, and that would be service. I don't think anybody should do that. I think you should give it to somebody. But you could read it that way.
I think it's the barcode case arguably addresses this. And it says, it seems to imply that in the office of is read literally. But that's with regard to 801.115A.
That's correct. The problem in barcode was the guy, there was something written on in a contract that the Square D had with Ameritech that said you have to go up to the 23rd floor of Ameritech when they got into what really happened, and the guy didn't do that. He went up to the security officer apparently in the lobby and talked to somebody that was not even an employee of Ameritech, but an employee of a security service who called her boss, who also was not working for Ameritech.
That language in the office of that is set forth in 5A is the same language in 4B. I can't think of any reason to construe it differently. And Gomez seems to suggest that with regard to in the office, it may be literal. Can you respond to that, or aren't you able to?
I'm not able to, Your Honor. That's a real good question.
Well, now, we've got a lot of cases that say service of summons and complaint and have to be strictly construed. You got to follow the letter of the law, regardless of the spirit, and regardless of actual notice. And if you don't, you're out.
I agree.
That whole line of cases.
I agree.
And at the same time, as you correctly point out, we got cases that haven't followed the exact letter of the law, haven't quite touched every base.
That's true.
And yet the court says, okay, you got a good lawsuit going anyway.
Well, some courts, Your Honor, act as courts of equity, and that's when you had writs and you had the chancellor, and the chancellor tried to do equity. I think even Morita, when we had argument before Judge Nanigan, was talking about estoppel and things of that nature. Here, I don't think that MERS intentionally tried to mislead anybody. I just don't think that happened. I think that somebody's new and sends them to the clerk's office and.
Okay.
Maybe Fred should ask more questions. I don't know.
Oh, what rule of law? You know, we ultimately have to come out with an opinion. It not only governs you, and it not only governs MERS, but it governs a lot of people in the future and a lot of different city offices and maybe state offices, county offices, maybe even corporations. So what rule of law do we get from all of this that covers all your rights and all these combinations and permutations of rights and wrongs that you got?
Well, I think the courts, try to get to the merits of these cases so that they do substantial justice as opposed to being hyper-technical. I don't think you can create a situation where people intentionally or negligently should be able to mislead process servers.
And yours is a professional process server.
That's correct.
It's not like Joe Smith going in who never served, doesn't understand anything. I mean, here you paid good money for this.
We pay a lot for this.
Do they have malpractice liability insurance?
They do.
So you paid good
so
money.
So do I. Yeah,
So what rule of law? I mean, I know you want to win the case, but one of us up here is going to have to write this case and going to have to think of
a reason
for holding your way.
I think that when he showed it to the person who was apparently in charge in that office, that service, I think when Ann Barr sent it up to him, like in the Fontaine, that service, I think there's service here.
Yeah, the difficulty, excuse me, that I would, assuming that, you know, we're talking about a rule of law, is that when you have there's this factual dispute that has been alluded to by myself and Justice Bradley as far as who did what. And the concern I have is where you have an allegation or just an affidavit that this was left. And I don't know who's right and who's wrong, but it's difficult to write on that basis based on the facts in this case, because I could see where if you had left something in that office, regardless, then it would be a lot easier. But here you have competing affidavits in the sense that you were there or you weren't there. But we know this, that where service was finally made was in the wrong office.
That's correct.
Yes.
He was in the right office, the right person, and went to the wrong office and the wrong person. And, you know, the court did treat this as a motion for summary judgment under 80208, although she brought a motion to dismiss. And I know, and I can't cite you the cases, I think one's called Coleman, that this court and the Court of Appeals didn't like summary judgment to be a battle of affidavits. You know, usually, sometimes, I mean, I think if I was the judge, I'd like to say, hey, could you recognize the person that you talked to? Or, you know, Fred, were you really there? I mean, we don't really know what happened at that moment in time. I can't believe you'd go to the wrong place.
So you're saying, well, maybe we ought to send this back and have a trial on whether you were there or you weren't there?
It seems to me there's a question of fact about it, Your Honor. I think you're right.
Unless we decide as a matter of law you served.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. And I see my ran out of time. I got a red light.
Thank you. And you got five minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Sheedy.
My name is Marie DeHaren. I'm the Assistant City Attorney. I represent the Milwaukee Employees Retirement System of the City of Milwaukee that I will refer to as MERS in my argument. Before I get into my argument, I'd like to correct two points. One is, I think the affidavits of Ann Barr clearly set forth a factual dispute regarding whether or not Mr. Meyer was at that office on April 27th. She says in her affidavits that, number one, this is not the procedure that is followed. There is a specific procedure in place. Her first affidavit, I should back up, says we were never served. The second affidavit says we have this procedure in place. There are three people who should be called, and there's a whole line, 1, 2, 3. If one isn't in the office, then Mr. Mattson, then Ms. Shannon. This was not done. And also, based on an investigation, they found that no one had any knowledge of this ever happening. So I think there's clearly a factual dispute. The other thing is, there's nothing in the record to suggest.
Counsel, let me just interrupt for a minute. If you're conceding there's a factual dispute, then how is summary judgment appropriate here?
Because as the trial court concluded, and I agree, it's irrelevant. And that may be when I get into my argument, if I could address that when I get in my argument.
So you're saying there's a factual dispute, but it's not a genuine issue of material fact.
Exactly. The other thing is that it is not in the record is that the city clerk's office sent this to MERS. There is nothing in the record to suggest that, and that is not the procedure of the city clerk's office. When they get a summons and complaint, it is sent up to our office, city attorney's office.
And you're the attorney for both the city and for MERS?
I represent MERS, but yes, our office does, unless there's a conflict.
Why doesn't that, once you got it, why doesn't that count as service?
Well, service isn't proper on the city attorney's office. There's a service isn't proper on the city attorney's office. There's a specific statute. MERS is the corporate name of the retirement system that administers the retirement benefits to not only City of Milwaukee employees, but also employees of other governmental entities, including Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, the Milwaukee Area Technical College, some employees of Milwaukee Public Schools, the Wisconsin Center, Housing Authority, and the Redevelopment Authority. MERS is a separate body politic from the City of Milwaukee.
And you are not a
not an officer, director, or managing agent of MERS?
No.
You are not?
I am not, correct.
And that's why service, if it was sent up to your office, is not appropriate?
That is correct. This certiorari review action was brought against only one defendant, MERS. It is undisputed that MERS was never served with an authenticated copy of the summons and complaint. Only the city of Milwaukee was. Both this court and the Court of Appeals have held in previous cases, including American Family, Burnett, Barcode, and Gomez, all cases cited in my brief, that failure to serve a summons, authenticated copy of the summons and complaint within the statutorily prescribed time period is a fundamental defect that deprives the court of personal jurisdiction over that defendant.
Doesn't that beg the question, counsel? The question that we have before us is whether it was left in the office of an officer, director, or managing agent with the person who is apparently in charge of the office. If that is fulfilled, then service is deemed to have been made.
I didn't read it, though. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest it was ever left in that office. The only evidence in the record is that from Mr. Meyer is that he went there and then he was told to go someplace else. It was never left there.
Well, I guess there's a difference. There may be arguably a difference between meeting the legal requirement of service, which is left in the office of an officer, director, or managing agent with a person who is apparently in charge of the office. I mean, if that is met, that legal requirement is met, then service is deemed to have been made. Let's say the person was not in charge. The person was absolutely not in charge. But the person, to a reasonable process server, was apparently in charge. So then service would be deemed to have been made. Is that correct?
Well, then I think you have the Keske and Horgan cases where this court has said that if that process server reasonably believes that that is the person in charge, then service can be effectuated. But that is not what happened here. There was nothing left at the offices. And it is disputed that anyone was ever there in the first place.
I need some help in this. As I read the supplemental affidavit of Ann Barr, I had the impression that the bottom line of MERS is, look, personnel has no knowledge of ever referring anyone to the city office for acceptance. That you ask the employees, our investigation has revealed that the front office personnel has no knowledge of ever referring anyone. I don't read that, but maybe that's what you're saying I should do. I don't read this as saying we're denying it. I read this as saying we have no knowledge.
Well, I think it has to be read with the first affidavit, which is we were never served. We have nothing in our record showing that we were ever served, and we would keep a copy of what was served. That coupled with the second affidavit, and I should point out, Mr. Meyer's affidavit didn't pop up until after the summary judgment had been made, summary judgment motion had been filed. And then it was first learned this is what was being claimed. And when it was sent down for her to investigate, and also I think you have to look at that last paragraph in conjunction with the procedure. There is a very specific procedure when someone comes to serve process. She is called, second in command is called, third is command. And if they are not there, they are told to come back. And so I think the two affidavits clearly create at least a question of fact as to what happened. But no, the first affidavit says we were never served with the summons and complaint. The supplemental affidavit was just to say we have no knowledge. The other thing that has to be remembered, there has been no identification of who this person is.
Well, let me give it this case a hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
Let me assume that a process server came to your office.
Yes.
And let me assume that the process server was told by the receptionist, oh, you should go to the city clerk's office because that's where process is received in this building. And the process server went to the city clerk's office and served the person. Do you concede that if that hypothetical were true, that at least the process, that a reasonable process server could believe that he was serving someone with apparent authority to receive process?
No. And I think I've addressed that in my brief. I think if the summons clearly states it's room 603 and you're talking to a receptionist and your process server who has been paid good money, they're supposed to have knowledge of the statutes and who to serve.
Okay, but I, you know, you're contesting that what I suggested happened. I mean, you know, here I am. You know, I'm Henry. I'm a 45-year-old guy who's a process server. And I've got my process. And let's say I'm going to go to an office on Main Street, the ABC company, and I say, here I am, process. I'm serving process to you, office, ABC company on Main Street, and I want to know who I am supposed to serve. And the person at the desk says, oh, you're supposed to go next door, and that's where our process is served. With that hypothetical, do you think a reasonable process server, having been told by the person at the office of ABC where to go to serve process on ABC, do you think a reasonable process server could conclude that this is the person with apparent authority to receive the process for ABC? Is that reasonable or is that unreasonable?
Sure, it's reasonable. But does that necessarily mean that personal jurisdiction should be found? I don't agree.
No, because you need another component. Because the statute says it has to be left in the office of such officer, director, or managing agent with the person who's apparently in charge of the office.
Correct. And I think that...
But under my hypothetical, at least half of it you were agreeing to.
I think it could be reasonable.
It could be reasonable.
But, I'm sorry. But then the question is, do we end the inquiry there to determine whether or not you should find personal jurisdiction here when a completely different political entity is being, it was served? And I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances.
I just want to right now look at the statute. So what is meant by left in the office of?
I got this. Thank you. Left in the office?
Mm-hmm. Of the director, mm-hmm. officer, et cetera.
Well, and I have a little bit difficulty understanding the question, but I think it means that if you can't serve the officer, director, or managing agent, then you can serve someone in charge of that office. Now, whether or not it also may mean you can just leave a copy with anyone there, possibly.
It doesn't mean just someone in charge of the office, because let me give you an opportunity to find that statute.
I have it.
Thank you. I mean, as I read 4B, you need two requirements. Well, you need maybe three. Delivering the summons and complaint. The copy must be left in the office of such officer, director, and managing agent with the person who's apparently in charge of the office. So when I asked you what was meant by in the office of you, such person, you said, well, leaving with someone apparently in charge of the office. That's the second part of the of that phrase. So what's meant by must be left in the office of in that statute?
Well, the way I read it is that if you don't do A in lieu thereof, you can leave it with someone in charge of the office of the managing agent or officer.
But what if that person that was in charge of the office happened to be across the street having lunch at the diner? That's, according to your interpretation, that would be okay then,
I'm sorry, could you ask me that again?
Yes, I understand you to be saying that all that is needed for service is that you leave it with the person who's apparently in charge of the office.
Of an officer, director, or managing agent.
Yes, and that I'm saying if that person then is during a lunch hour at the diner, you can go over and leave it with the person that you think is apparently in charge of the office, even though the person isn't located in the office. Is that what you're saying?
I see what you're saying. So the person has to actually be physically in the office.
That's what I'm trying to get to, yeah.
I never really thought about that. I think in one of the cases, I don't know if it was Corrigan or Keskey, I think that was kind of the factual scenario. He was in an office next door.
And a couple of feet away.
Right. And I think the court said...
Good
even
enough.
Right. Exactly. It was good enough that you weren't in there.
But we're not a couple of feet away here, I assume.
Well, I don't even think this is service at all. I mean, the city clerk's office is not the correct person to serve or correct entity to serve to get service over MERS. This is a completely different governmental body. The city of Milwaukee is governed by 801.11a.4.3, and this is a.4.7, and that was clearly brought out in the Watkins case. You don't serve the city clerk to get jurisdiction over MERS.
So regardless of what happened here, you're saying that he may have come into the office, and you're even denying, you have no idea, but that nothing was done there, nothing was left. There was no inquiry, so therefore service could not have been made, period.
Correct. Nothing was left there.
Right.
He went down to the city clerk's office, according to him.
As I see the circumstances of this case, they are not covered by either the statute or any of the cases that either of you have cited. What we have is an obvious failure of service, according to the terms of the statute, and an allegation that that failure of service was the result of an affirmative misdirection by the agency that was being served. And that's a matter that the cases do not address. We have to decide how that should be addressed and send it back for an evidentiary hearing on the issue of what actually happened on the day that that alleged misdirection occurred.
I think that was
at a fair characterization.
And I think that was discussed at the trial level.
But the trial judge didn't address that. The trial judge made his entire decision based on the procedural issue that the affirmative defense of failure of personal jurisdiction for failure of service was pleaded, and there wasn't a correction of that service. That was the entire basis for the trial judge's decision here. He did not address any of these substantive issues.
Well, I did file a brief, and I know I did cite the American Family case in the brief.
I know you did, but he didn't. And so his entire decision was based on that failure to correct service once the defense was pleaded, as I read it.
Well, I think he did on two. I think he said there was never any service, and that's not disputed. And even if these allegations of Mr. Meyer are true, you did not correct it.
Right, but he failed to address the effect of this affirmative misdirection.
Because I think in his mind, it was irrelevant. I mean, this court has said in American Family, failure to serve is a fundamental defect. And, you know, Corrigan and Keskey were decided before this court adopted the fundamental technical defect analysis. And I think if it seems to me, if you were looking at Corrigan and Keskey today, under this analysis, it would be determined that the failure to actually serve the person in charge is a technical defect.
But as I understand it, that's not your legal position. You're not arguing that the affirmative misdirection that occurred in room 603 of City Hall in downtown Milwaukee has no legal significance whatsoever. You're saying that's an issue of fact that's in dispute, Your Honor. I understood your argument to the circuit court and your argument here.
I'm saying it was irrelevant because service was never effectuated on MERS. And because service was never effectuated on MERS, and I'm unaware of any case that says you can serve the city and then that will be service on another governmental entity.
No, I understand that, but the question is the legal significance of this act of alleged misdirection in Room 603.
And the only theory advanced is that this comes under Horrigan and Keske, and I said it doesn't. And I think it's irrelevant.
No, I don't disagree with you on that, but the cases just don't address this situation. It's new.
I don't know what the legal theory is. You know, I don't know what – waiver can only occur if the affirmative defense of lack of jurisdiction is not contained in the answer or a motion to dismiss. The Court of Appeals in Sakoti has said there is no equitable estoppel applicable to jurisdiction. If jurisdiction isn't there, then we don't apply equitable estoppel to confer it.
So your position is take everything that Mr. Hagan has said as true, all of his affidavits. Let's just accept that the process server went to your office, to MERS. MERS told him to go somewhere else. He goes somewhere else and he goes to the city office. He deposits it there. Ultimately, it gets to your office through the person who was served. Accepting all that is true, your position is, as a matter of law, it doesn't change anything.
Correct.
So the fact that there's a dispute as to whether he did go to your office in MERS and he did get that instruction, that's why you're saying it's irrelevant.
Correct.
So the consequences of that misdirection fall on the plaintiff.
I think given that there were 41 days to cure the defect, and this is where I think Judge Donegan dwelled on, given that there were 41 days to cure the defect, that defect was not cured, even though they were not only placed on notice, they were told what they didn't do right. And it was clear that the process server knew he served the city clerk. He said, I served the city clerk. Minimal effort would have shown that, and they could have cured the defect. And that was what Judge Donegan decided. He said, you know, it's undisputed that you didn't serve the right party. You had time to cure it. I think for this court to hold and to deviate from their prior holdings that, and this is what is being asked to do. You're being asked to say that service on the city of Milwaukee is sufficient to confer personal jurisdiction over another governmental entity, Milwaukee Employers Retirement System. For you to hold that, I think you have to look at the whole set of circumstances. This is a fundamental requirement for personal jurisdiction. And to look at the totality of the circumstances here, if someone is placed on notice that what they did is incorrect, regardless of what the process server thought at the time, or maybe he was a little misdirected, the fact of the matter is it is the plaintiff's burden to effectuate service of process. And the Court of Appeals, and I think it is this Stodelsky case, which I cited, even goes on to say, look, if there is in the affirmative defense or in your responsive pleading, the other party is put on notice, you plaintiff have a responsibility to check into it.
Counsel.
As I understand the trial court's decision is set forth on page 127 of the plaintiff's appendix. The trial court said, look, there's no service because the employee retirement system has to be served and it hasn't been served. And that's your position.
Correct.
The trial court then went on to say the plaintiff got notice by way of affirmative defense and there was no repair of that problem. The Court of Appeals takes, it seems to me, a little different approach. In paragraph 17 of the Court of Appeals opinion, and I'm referring to page 109 now of the plaintiff's appendix also, page 9 of the slip opinion.
I have it.
They say in the second sentence, rather he was in the wrong office altogether. He wasn't in the office of an officer, director, et cetera, or a MERS. And so they seem to be taking the approach to continue that, in order for service to be effective by leaving a copy, of the summons with someone apparently in charge of the office under the statute. You know, it has to be, you got to be in the right office, and this guy was in the wrong office altogether. So they were plugging into the statute and saying he's just in the wrong office. You following me?
He was in the wrong office for the service. I mean, initially he says he went to the right office, but he didn't serve the correct office. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals is saying. I mean, they go on to say this is like going to, what is it, trying to serve American Family and you go to State Farm.
Does it make any difference at all if the process server reasonably believed he was in the right office?
You mean downstairs in City Clerk's office?
Yes.
No. It's still, I mean, not, no. Given the facts that that is the wrong, and I think that's what the Court of Appeals is saying, you served the wrong party.
It does make a difference if he reasonably believed he was serving a person who was in charge of the office, right?
Yes, because that's the Keskey and Horgan case. And I think then you get back to this fundamental versus technical distinction that this Court has carved out.
But your position is, with regard to whether or not he was physically in the correct office, that it makes no difference if he reasonably believed that to be true or not.
Correct.
No, in those cases in which we carved out those exceptions, that the service was on somebody who was apparently in charge, was there ever any doubt that the person or that the party that was supposed to have been served was aware that the process had begun? See, I can see, I, from your standpoint, I'm looking at it and saying, if plaintiff should prevail in this case, it was only by, I would have, you know, mere fortuitous chance that you actually got notice that there was a lawsuit that had proceeded. But what if this city clerk had sat on the pages and then you never, your office never got notice? You know, you didn't know, I should say, rather than use the words notice, because that's got a legal connotation.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know that a process had begun. I mean, they could default you.
Well, and that's what happened in the barcode case. And the trial court granted a default, and the Court of Appeals said, no, you have no jurisdiction over this case, over the person to grant this default.
Could I ask you, city clerk received the summons.
And complaint, yes.
And from what you indicated, the city clerk's office sent the summons to you, is that right?
Correct. To our office. To our office.
To your office.
Yes.
Has MERS ever received a copy of the summons?
I probably gave them one at some point.
Did you give them one before you filed your answer?
I can't recall. I know I would have asked them if they had been served with this, but I can't recall.
But did you go to the office, or did you send it by inter-D, or how did they get that thing to
them? You know, I can only tell you, you know, it's been a while. I can only tell you that I'm sure I would have asked them, because I would not have filed the answer. And that the procedure is they always send up, whenever they're served, the summons and complaint to our office by letter, and because they have reporting requirements. That was never done. And, you know, I at some point probably did send down a summons and complaint for their files, you know, but I don't recall when. And I can't specifically say I did.
Is that service?
No. No, and I think that's the I think that's the Sicotti case, where the lawyer was served. Or they tried to serve the lawyer. But I'm sure there's the Sicotti case to address serving a lawyer is not proper service. I mean, the statute is very specific who has to be served.
Right. If the city clerk had received the summons and then taken it up to room 603, that wouldn't have been adequate, is that right?
Correct.
And why?
because the statute specifies how service of process is to be had. And this court has said that those rules have to be strictly construed. And these are, that would be like saying, I went to American Family and served them, and I'm going to send it over to State Farm. And the purpose of the service requirement is to give notice of the lawsuit and obtain personal jurisdiction. And if you don't do it right, you don't have personal jurisdiction over that person, whether it's a governmental entity or not. The case law is clear on that.
Could you just summarize what policy, what good policy is served by ruling in favor of the of MERS?
Well, I think that it's in compliance with the existing law, and I think it is consistent with this court's holding in American Family that you have to properly serve any defendant. And just because we're a governmental entity, we shouldn't somehow, you know, the statute shouldn't be relaxed because we're a governmental entity. We have the right, just like any other person, private litigant, to have the statutes followed. I do want to say in closing that if this court does decide to extend its holdings in Keskey and Horrigan, then it's my position that there is a question of fact as to whether or not what the process server did was reasonable. And if that's going to be the conclusion, then I think it should be remanded for a determination in the circuit court as to factually what did occur and also whether or not the actions done by Mr. Meyer were reasonable. But that's only if this court decides to extend Keskey and Horrigan to the facts of this case. I don't think it should be. I think it's factually distinguishable as noted by the Court of Appeals, and I also think to extend it is inconsistent with this court's holding in American Family. Okay?
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sheedy?
Like I'm back in law school, I kind of enjoyed this. I just want to point out, Your Honor, that the holding in Keskey is, this court has said, you don't want to produce a situation where a process server becomes a participant in a game of hide-and-seek at the mercy of secretaries or anyone else who chooses to prevent him from accomplishing his task. Now, that's what happened here. And I think that His Honor was correct. If somebody else handed it to him, that service, anybody can serve process that's over age 18. In fact, if you look at that, Judge Sundby's concurring opinion in Gomez, he indicates if it weren't for the fact that it was an administrative agency, he would find that there was proper service. Because it went to the wrong agency. It went to the workers' comp. The workers' comp people took it up to the LIRC and gave it to them. And he said that would, under Fontaine, which is a case from 1966, he said that would be service. I don't think, in closing, I don't think the court should create situations where people get misled negligently or intentionally. That's the problem here. None of these cases that any of us cite here actually fit what happened in this situation.
That's true, and the misleading part is as both of you have said, it's a factual thing. But the court, I think the problem I have is that unless we do send it back, it would be very difficult.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's been a enjoyable experience.
Before you sit down, I have one final question in Fargo.
You can let me go.
And I'm looking, you don't need to have it in front of you.
I think that was
it. Barcode is discussing some argument of a merit tech and says it finds it persuasive, and it says the proper analysis must begin with the first question as to whether or not in the office of such officer, director, or managing agent. And it says if you fail the first question because the process server simply fails to locate the correct office, service cannot be accomplished, and therefore the second question of whether or not
it was a person apparently in charge need not be addressed. Do you have any response to that at all?
Well, if I remember correctly, in bar code, he didn't even make it to the correct office, which is completely different than what happened here. Fred says that he went into the correct office and was sent out. And that's why each one of these cases, if you charted them out, a little bit different. It's like a game, because they're all a little bit just different than each other as to what happened. Right offices, wrong persons, wrong offices, wrong persons. It's an interesting case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Rashidi. Thank you, Mr. Horan. We certainly enjoyed your first appearance here, and we look forward to seeing you again. That ends our hearing on 01-3198, Hagen versus Merz, and that ends our sitting on the April calendar. Court is adjourned.